So guys, let's get right into it. I'm sitting here in Calgary, Alberta, Canada, just finishing up a course. Gav's out there teaching for the next 15 to 30 minutes before I get out there. So I want to get right into this. And a lot of things come up with the course. So for those of you that don't know, Gav and I are out here teaching the Muscle Intelligence Way, the Muscle Intelligence Method, really focused around what we call phase one, which is the six things that we must focus on to optimize for progress and results. Matt, what's up, man? I see you looking lean and jacked over there. So we're here focused on ultimately helping other coaches in the world get results the way we do. And obviously our coaches are very, very well versed in this stuff. And people have asked me specifically and Gav, come on and talk about muscle building and like what drives muscle building and how are we so good at getting results so fast? And maybe some of the things that have changed in my thought process and our thought process as a community over the last, 2 to 5 years, 2 to 3 years, a lot of things have actually evolved, right? And having to be willing to evolve your thought process is part of being a successful human. And so many of us get stuck in our ways of like, hey, this is what I've always done, this always worked, and like that doesn't work. So I'm more than happy to be humbled in my thought process when something coming this and the matters in the last 18 months, I've completely changed the way that I personally train, and I feel like my results have skyrocketed with less result, with less effort. So I can put in exponentially less work than I did certainly in my peak. And here's the crazy thing: I don't feel as bad after a workout. I don't feel like I've had my butt kicked because how many of you guys personally attach to having to feel like you had your butt kicked when you leave the gym to think you've had a great workout? For many years I was that guy. I was like, man, I have to leave here feeling like I had my ass handed to me, or it just wasn't a good workout. And so I flipped my focus on that. And so I want you to know that fatigue is actually an interference mechanism. It's not an objective. It's not a primary objective of exercise. It's an interference mechanism with progress. So if I'm fatigued, I can't actually induces much muscle building. Fatigue stops muscle building, which is important. I don't just go in there to have my ass kicked and feel like I'm tired. I can do a bunch of burpees and feel tired, and that doesn't do anything useful for my body, certainly from a perspective of building muscle. It might be useful as far as inducing fatigue, which I can talk about as a separate. There's value in inducing fatigue, but it's not in muscle building. So I want you guys to all just see that. And so when it comes to inducing maximum muscle building, maximum growth, ultimately maximum fat loss, which both mechanistically are going related on the same line, the primary target has to be tension, right? So we used to think there was three primary targets of muscle building, but now we know there's one. We used to think it was tension, muscle damage, and metabolic stress. But now we know tension and stress no longer drive growth. It's just tension. It's just this mechanical tension, the end-to-end pulling on two bones. So I need to maximize how much I can do. Now, there's a lot of things that could stand in your way. And then primary thing that's can well, the two primary things that are going to stand in your way are skill and stability, right? So if you don't have the skill to move through a range of motion and make sure that the muscle you're trying to train is actually the very thing that's doing the work or receiving the tension, exercise execution mastery is your first priority. So do things well. Now, here's how you know. Can you stop at every inch of every rep and say, yes, I can definitively say that the muscle I'm trying to train is doing the work? And if you can't, you're not doing it correctly. And so my objective is I want to be able to stop at every inch or even every centimeter and say, yes, the muscle I'm trying to train is actually doing the work, right? This is the whole premise of exercise execution mastery. Like I need to be able to direct tension like I'm the conductor of a symphony going, you contract. You contract at all different lengths of the muscle range and all different lengths of the contractile and exercise. Okay, so that's kind of step one. Second step, can I? So, first step, can I move through the range? Skill, do I have the skill? Second step, I have to scale stability. So, if I'm not stable at any point, I'm not building muscle. Stability governs contractile ability. So, if I'm less stable, like I'm standing on a Bosu ball, my ability to contract muscle goes down. So we don't, that's not going to drive growth at all. So our objective is how do I maximize stability and how do I maximize skill so that I can express maximum strength? The rep range for which we train for maximum hypertrophy is between 5 and 7 repetitions, ideally. Now, here's the thing. Not everyone has the ability to train in 5 to 7 reps, because if I give you a weight you can do for 5 to 7 reps, it may be too heavy for you to control. So sometimes we start off with sets of 10 to 12, or sometimes we do 15 to 20. And the reason I personally program 15 to 20 somewhat often is not for hypertrophy. It's for two reasons. One, it's going to help you improve stability, which is one of the things we want to do. Two, it's going to help you induce resistance to fatigue. I want to eventually be more resistant to be getting tired. But guess when I do that? I don't do that early in the workout. I do that late in the workout. So the first 2 to 3 exercises in a workout should be focused primarily on maximally generating tension in the muscle. That requires skill and stability. Toward the end of the workout, I want to induce resistance to fatigue, which can be done through maybe more dense workouts, like less rest periods or longer time under tension, right? But we do that intentionally later in the workout. Now, I can get into the mechanisms of as to why this is, if you guys would like, but I think it's probably unnecessary. People don't want to hear about calcium ion accumulation and how that is blunting progress, right? For the most part, most people don't want to hear about calcium ion accumulation. However, I will say this. So you'll hear some people on the internet saying, you can induce hypertrophy anywhere between 5 reps and 30 reps, which is technically true, but there's actually some mechanisms at the level of the brain that shut down hypertrophy. And what that is in fact, this, if we exceed our total sensory capacity, sensory tolerable level, meaning if I'm doing an exercise and the total amount of sensation in my body everywhere exceeds what I'm able to tolerate, my muscles will shut off. My brain will shut off. My muscles will shut off. So if I have to do a set of 15, 20, 25, 30 reps to induce this signal for muscle building, and I'll tell you what the signal is in a minute. If I have to do 25 or 15, 20, 25 reps to induce a signal, chances are I may never get to that signal because I may get tired. I may be out of breath. I may lose focus first. So the actual signal for muscle building is not just any particular rep range. It's actually something known as the force velocity curve, meaning a rep range has to start, or a rep cadence has to start slowing down even when you're trying to push as hard as you can. You guys have all experienced that at some point toward the end of a set. You know, the first few reps are probably quick or comfortably fast. And then as you start to get tired, the reps actually start to slow down. That actual process of the force velocity curve slowing down, so the velocity goes down, the force production goes up, that's actually the key to inducing hypertrophy. Now, that's a requirement. And now we don't always get there if we're doing sets of 15, sets of 20, because sometimes we get tired or we get distracted or our lungs are burning or something else happens. This is why I think we should all aspire to get to these 5 to 7 rep ranges. So the greatest number of repetitions are maximally effective, right? So if I pick up a set of 5, every one of those reps is hard, especially if it's like a 5 rep max. They're hard. Even if it's a 7 rep max and I do 5 reps, they're hard. And they're probably not going to be super fast and easy. So my ability to induce hypertrophy with those reps is high. So my efficiency is high. Let's say I do this set of 20, only the last 3 reps are getting near this force velocity kind of objective. So I've got 17 reps that are kind of wasted time. I think they're useful for inducing improvements in skill and stability. But as far as improving in inductions in hypertrophy, they're not. So I know I'm saying a lot of words, and hopefully you guys are following me. But what I want to get at is this simple process. First, you must do. Second, you must do well. And third, you must do well with effort. And effort looks like, hey, can we get you to the point where you're doing 5 to 7 reps with huge amounts of effort, huge amounts of intensity, and ultimately inducing reductions in this force velocity curve? So velocity goes down, force production goes up. I'm going to pause and take a breath and kind of take a pulse for like, does that make any sense? Or you want me to kind of go back and reverse into some stuff? Greg, Andrew, Steve, any of you guys want to comment or ask for clarity on?
I just want to say, I think it's amazing seeing Jimmy in his sauna. It's the best. Ben, you still have a cold?
No, I just got a little, I don't know, I had like an allergy or something, man. I'm good.
Gotcha. No, I love all this stuff. This is it's great information because I think that it's something that's very applicable, and it's you get that a lot with a lot of people. They talk about how they're either in a set and they give up, or not give up, but they're not able to continue because they're panting or they feel like that bottleneck, and then it's always the next thing on the horizon. But I think this is something that people can it almost gives inspiration as well to film your video, or sorry, to video your sets, so you can actually see it. Because I've had a lot of clients, they might experience the set being like hard, then they film it and every rep is the same, right? And there's no slowdown. And it's like, it's okay. Like you might be experiencing that, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's real.
Yeah, man, and there's value in training like that too, as you know, Steve. If it never slows down, there's still a value in improving skill, right? I can still, like, if I have the desire to get better at the skill, then I don't go anywhere near these reductions in velocity, right? I'm just like, stop short of that. I want to make sure the form stays dialed in, and once I've reached unconscious competence, then I can drive up that the how close we get to fatigue. So personally, if I'm training a new client, I want to stay in that 6 to 7 rep range, but I'm going to say, hey, look, pick a weight you can do for 10 reps. And we're going to stop at, seven rep, eight, like leave at least 2 to 3 reps in reserve.
I found it one of the really interesting points that was made in some of that research that's been spoken about is you hear a lot of times through different people speaking in the industry where they always tend to mention it's like you shouldn't take anything close to muscular failure. So always leave reps left in reserve. When really, when we look at a lot of this research, it's telling us that we never actually get near that anyway. Because it's a brain problem that shuts it down more so than an actual muscular failure problem.
Oh,
And
dude,
the only
I'll talk.
way to make that better is to actually go there.
Yep. So that's another reason why I like to program 20 sometimes, Greg. Because, like, as you know, if we do a set of 20 today and your next workout is sets of 3 to 6 or 4, 5 to 6, you're like, oh, this is easy. So the brain perception of effort is less. So when you start going deep into that level of discomfort and you're like, oh my gosh, there's just so much sensation. The next time I come back doing 5 to 6, I'm like, gosh, there's no sensation here at all. So it allows me to work hard. So that's my argument for people who say, well, sets of 20 aren't valuable. I will say this. The people who are arguing against going to failure, going to complete muscular failure, the mechanism they usually spout is calcium ion accumulation. And they're not incorrect. So when we accumulate calcium ion accumulation, which is ultimately calcium ion fatigue, we do decrease force production a lot. And so people say, well, don't ever go near it because that's bad. And like, that's not true. You actually want to go near it because there's value in that, in helping the body become more effective at clearing these calcium ions through mitochondrial biogenesis. So it's just when you do it that's important. So if we don't, if we do the first exercise and we went right to failure, the rest of the workout will probably see a decrease in performance. But the same holds true as if the foot right early in the workout, if we did some really stretched, emphasized exercise, like overemphasizing the stretch, the rest of the workout will also see a decrease in the performance. So the metaphor I use here in camp is if I'm Usain Bolt and I need to sprint the 100 meters as fast as I can, if I were to start my workout, like say I'm running the Olympics, I'm running the 100 meter final. And let's say before I do it, I decide to sprint 400 meters a couple times around the lap, around the track. How fast am I going to run that 100 meters? Clearly, we all can think, well, obviously, his ability to, no matter how long he rests, unless he rests an entire day, even an entire day might not be enough. Unless he rests an entire day, he's not going to sprint the 100 meters as fast. But if he ran a bunch of 100 meters at like 8 out of 10, 7 out of 10, 8 out of 10, maybe, like even a 9 out of 10, I wouldn't go there. I'd save it. I'd run a bunch of sixes and sevens and eights. And one time, he's going to run a 10 to 10. If he has to run more than that, he's done. And that's really what happens. As soon as you run that one 10 to 10, all the volume afterwards is going to be less effective. You guys all get me? Like, no matter how conditioned you are, Usain Bolt, the fastest runner in the world, can run it once at full speed. And then the next time, it's going to be less, regardless of his level of conditioning. So if he was to try to do it repeated bouts of that 100 meters, the most he could do is 8 or 10. He's going to like run at an 8 or 10 or run a shorter distance. Maybe you sprint for 30 meters. right? So it's a different, like, we can't go that close to fatigue and actually expect to continue to do high quality work over time. It's a good, I think it's a, that displays the point well. Anyone else have questions on this topic that you want me to get in on here? Lean in on?
Hey Ben, I was just going to ask if that 5 to 7 reps, is that pretty universal for muscle group to muscle group, or is there any differences there?
That's a great question. I'm going to say it's in general universal. It may swing a little bit in either direction for certain muscle groups, that some may be a little more slow twitch. Multiple joint muscles that cross joints that cross multiple joints may have some unique considerations that push them up a little bit to make them slightly higher repetitions, require slightly higher repetitions. But in general, that 5 to 7 range is where you want to be. Because of this, there's a model called the effective reps model. And so it doesn't mean we can't do 8 to 10, but if we do 8 to 10, the number of the percentage of effective reps is less. For example, if I'm doing 8 to 10 reps, I probably don't have to start having effective reps till I get to like 6 and 7. So the first 5 reps are they're useful, but they're not going to induce that decrease in velocity, increase in force production. Whereas if I shift the curve down a little bit and I'm using 5 to 7 reps, then almost every one of those reps is maximal efficiency. So it doesn't necessarily mean that doing 8 to 10 or 10 to 12 is not effective. It just means from an efficiency perspective, that's where you want to be. Doing different rep ranges, for example, you may not be great at doing 5 to 7 reps. Like students, some people, when they get grab a weight that's a 5 rep max, their form goes out the window. In which case, I'm like, well, I'm not going to make you do a 5 rep max. I might make you do an 8 or 10 rep max and then just keep 1 rep in reserve, right? So, like, it depends on your level of skill and focus, your ability to stay present in the workout. That's how we program, right? If you're a master of that exercise, then I'm probably going to inch you closer to the lower reps. You're still kind of learning a little bit. Well, maybe we stay on the higher end of that. Most people in my coaching, like I coach right now, about 15, 14, 15 people. Most of them at some point are doing sets of 15 to 20. Certainly in the beginning, when I'm trying to induce more stability, when I'm trying to induce more resistance to fatigue, certain different scenarios where I'm trying to intentionally induce specific outcomes. So Matt's asked a question here, actually. How much does time and tempo of that 5 to 7 reps influence the overall effectiveness? Great question, Matt. So my first kind of response to that is it depends on who's doing it. So the first tempo that I advocate everyone pay attention to and really nail down and drill in on is the tempo that says control, right? So whatever tempo you need to control a weight, that's where you start. And once you're masterful at controlling it, then you can start manipulating tempos. So start there. If you're not masterful at controlling an exercise, the only tempo you're concerned with is control in general, which means can I intentionally eccentrically lower and stop at every segment? And I can I intentionally concentrically raise and stop at every segment? Once you got that, then tempo becomes a consideration. Now, there once you've passed that point, meaning you've reached some degree of mastery, training at a faster concentric tempo seems to be more useful. However, you can't lose tension. And you got to remember that the body is designed to cheat. Your body has evolved for millions of years, hundreds of thousands or millions, whatever you want to believe, to make things as easy as possible. Path of least resistance, which means it's trying to distribute tension rather than focus tension. You're trying to focus tension. You're like, I need this muscle to do the greatest amount of work over the greatest amount of time. So it's different. So tempo matters, but it's nuanced when it matters. Greg.
A question, and it's something I was thinking about earlier on today. Do you think the use of anabolics would affect this in any way, shape, or form in terms of repetition or your ability to be able to go to failure more regularly?
Yes, 1000%. So the reason why, great question, Greg. So the reason testosterone has this amazing benefit of making discomfort or effort feel good. How many of you guys, when you became a young man or a teenager, started looking for things that were hard or uncomfortable. I think it's like this rite of passage thing that most kids go through. I know I did. Like when I was 14 to 15, I was just trying to hurt myself. I was doing things that were like, what can I do that makes me myself suffer? And so testosterone makes things that are effortful feel good. So if we know that the brain governs a lot of the decisions to go forward, right? So we talk about the perception of effort or this tolerable level of sensation, right? So if I exceed my tolerable level of sensation, I stop. Well, guess what? If my tolerable level of sensation is really, really high because I'm actually seeking that, then I can do a lot more because I'm like, oh, it's a dopamine switch, I think. It's like for me, when I find that discomfort, I'm like, fuck yeah, give me more of that. I want more, I want more, I want more. And I'm craving it. So rather than shutting down, I'm actually getting a dopamine hit from it. So I think there's a big consideration from that, which is obviously testosterone drives that. That's one way. Second way, we know that testosterone drives unique adaptations in the central nervous system. So we can have a shutdown in the brain, which is overcome. We can also have a shutdown in the central nervous system, which is obviously the wiring that connects from the brain into the muscular system. So if I was to do, say, for example, some extended time under tension, typically the fatigue doesn't happen at the level of the muscle or even the brain, happens in the CNS. So we know we have increased CNS function on anabolics. We also know we have increased muscle function. So like the musculotendinous junction may change, the energy, I guess the energetics would change. So there's a lot of mechanisms there, I think, why testosterone makes exercise one more enjoyable, two more effective. Anyone else got questions? So guys, why is this useful to you? Regardless of how you want to train or where you're training, you need to get your head around my goal is maximum tension, not getting tired. Fatigue is not a goal, at least at the beginning. Fatigue is a byproduct. Fatigue is also an interference mechanism. At the end of your work, I like personally, I've been thinking about inducing fatigue in different ways. Like, why don't I play sports? Why don't I, at the end of a workout, maybe I do some longer tempos and shorter rest periods. But I'm like, why can't I get on a bike and induce fatigue that way? Like, it's a different, I think you can do it in a different way. I'm still kind of fudging with that a little bit. But I'll tell you this. Driving tension requires heavy weight. It's not going to happen with the pink dumbbells. It's not going to happen just because your form is perfect doesn't mean it's going to work. It's not going to happen with bands, right? It's not going to happen with body weight. It's not going to happen. You can induce fatigue those ways, but you're not going to induce muscle growth. It's not going to happen, right? So from a signaling perspective, we have to have a high amount of signal and a low amount of noise. Right, signal to noise ratio has to be high. So high amount of signal means tension. The noise is going to be inflammation and fatigue, which is ultimately going to happen if you do things like super high reps or just train with bands all the time or these things like this. You must have the signal for muscle building, which obviously is tension. Anyone else got questions? All right. On that note, Mr. Gregory is going to take over and talk about nutrition for muscle building. Sean, welcome back, man. Glad to see you on here, brother. Greg, you all good to take over? All you, man.
Gentlemen, so to carry on from that, I guess we probably want to touch on the points that tend to actually, we'll think about it first at a macro level when we think about nutrition for muscle growth. And then we'll go into micronutrition that can assist the macro. So when I'm thinking about fat loss or muscle gain, I tend to think of everything at a macro level first before I dive into micronutrition. I think it's like putting the cart before the horse in certain circumstances where people will tell me, well, what multivitamin should I take? And it's like, hold on a minute. We need to have protein, carbs, and fats in order and hitting those targets before we start looking at the micronutrition needs that may come with that. And when we look at muscle growth in particular, It is different in a lot of ways to fat loss. So fat loss is very much substrate driven pathway. So you have less energy available than that you are burning. So you're consuming less than you're putting out at a very, very basic level. When we so the main goal when we go into fat loss is not meal timing. It's on obviously to regulate hunger can be quite important, but it's not one of the key components when you think about fat loss. You're generally thinking about caloric intake, protein intake to maintain muscle mass, and using some sort of stimulus to keep your muscle mass, like weight training, like Ben just spoke about. When we flip the switch and we turn around and we try and push up in terms of increasing muscle mass, it is very much a signal-driven pathway. So we need to stimulate muscle growth because we can just overeat, right? And what'll happen? We will accumulate very little muscle and gain an awful lot of fat. So things tend to change in these circumstances. So meal timing all of a sudden becomes an issue. So when we look at muscle growth, it's driven by a pathway called mTOR, the mammalian target of rapamycin. Not particularly important, but consider it as a growth factor. So it's something that we stimulate to make us grow. And that can be a really positive thing and can be a really negative thing because mTOR, you might see when you look out in the ether of nutrition where they say don't eat protein. A recent research just came out on rabbits that showed that eating too much protein gave them atherosclerosis. If anyone's actually read it, ignore it. But when we look at growth, we have to initiate the right stimulus. So think about it more so as we're obviously looking at it as growth, and with that growth, we want it to be muscle growth. Can you tell me why you should ignore it, Greg? Predominantly, first of all, because it was in rabbits. So dietary habits in rabbits tend to be very, very different. Thank you, Russell. But also the actual food choices that they use. So they said like healthy diet and unhealthy diet when it was completely processed food blended down. So it's very difficult way to put it across and transfer animal model over to human model. And that's the same for even stuff that I would agree with. Like if someone said to me about a certain supplement or diet that I like, and they go, well, there's studies on rabbits, I'd be like, I like it, I'd love to use it, but I can't, right? You need human data on that kind of stuff. But there's two ways that we can spike mTOR. There's two ways that we can spike mTOR. We can do it either through protein or we can do it through weight training. So if we consider both of those aspects, we obviously need an increase in protein intake and we need an increase, not necessarily in the amount of training you do, but in the intensity in which you do it. So what Ben spoke about, somewhere between 5 and 7 repetitions, is a really, really good way to do it. Now, we also need to stimulate that mTOR at different times of the day. So just doing one burst of it is not necessarily going to be benefit for you. And this is why meal timing tends to become a real issue when we look at muscle growth. And it can be a problem I have with clients where I'm like, I need you to go from eating whenever you wanted, really, in a calorie deficit, what affected your appetite, to now I'm needing to eat structured meals where there's not consistent gaps between meals. And normally the science will say somewhere between 4 and 5 meals a day of 20 to 30 grams at least of protein will give you that stimulus for growth. All right. So for most of you, you'll look at whatever particular target it may be. So whether that's 1 gram of protein per pound of body weight is normally a relatively safe place to start. You can go higher, but I'll tell you why it's not always the best idea just to keep pushing protein. When we look at people will always say protein is responsible for muscle growth and remodeling. And of course it is. But where do carbs come into this? So why would you see on a lot of diets that will tend to increase carbohydrate intake when we go into a surplus? One of it is for energy production, right? So it fuels us when we train in an awful, in a much more, and I'll get into this in a little bit, maybe not efficient way, but in an acute stage where you're trying to replenish energy really quickly, it's really beneficial to use carbohydrate over fat. And we'll talk about that in a little minute. If anyone wants to have the argument with me, you're more than welcome. But with carbohydrates, it does something else that's really cool that fat cannot do. It's called anaplerosis. So what it does is it actually spares amino acids when we eat it. I'm not going to get into the biochemistry of it because it is deep and I struggle to understand it myself. But basically, when we have enough carbohydrates, then we do not use protein to produce energy in the same way. So we spare those amino acids for other processes that we want them to be involved in. So, like when we look at muscle growth, okay? So increasing carbohydrate intake to a certain level is very, very important when we look at going into a surplus. Can you put on muscle on a high fat, high protein diet? Yeah. Is it going to be as efficient? You probably won't train as well, and you won't spare as much amino acids. So it wouldn't be the way I'd personally go with someone's diet if I'm looking at a surplus, right? Now, so they're the two considerations in terms of macros for muscle growth. What do we look like in terms of energy production? So, not necessarily associated with muscle growth per se, but it's really important when we think about how we're going to produce energy when we train. We're now in a surplus. We have available energy sources. So, what would you want to use as a client or as a trainee when you're training? There has been research out there that has said that in certain circumstances, a higher fat intake will be of just as much benefit as carbohydrates. It's weak. So the research is weak. And I know from a lot of you guys who do regular weight training, you are going to want to use carbohydrate when you train. And the reason why is it because not necessarily because it produces more energy, because it doesn't. Fat produces way more energy than carbohydrates do. They just do not do it at the same pace. Glycogen, glucose, all these things you've heard of, whether it's stored or floating carbohydrate, is localized to your muscle. If you want to use fat, you have to take it out of your fat cell, attach it to albumin, get it to the cell, and then metabolize it. It is really, really slow. I'll answer that in a minute, Russell. So carbohydrates are definitely the most effective fuel source that you're going to want when you're looking at increasing performance and sparing protein. Fat for general overall health is really, really important. And you probably want to sit and the conversion here I'm going to suck with, but I'm going to use kilograms, but at least a gram of fat per kilogram. And that's for other health purposes. So whether that's hormone production, whether it's the cell membrane within every cell in your body, there is purposes for it, of course there is, but not as much for muscle growth. Now, when you start to break down, and does that make sense to a lot of you guys? So you want to just consider both muscle growth and energy production when we're trying to increase muscle mass. This is going outside of all the other things in your life that you need to get in under control, like whether that's stress, whether that is like sleep quality, all those other things will obviously influence how much muscle you gain. But these are the things that you want to see. The amount of information out there on micronutrition based around muscle growth is limited. So when we think about vitamins and minerals, you think about the ones that will actually play a role in muscle growth. There is definitely evidence out there to say that vitamin D and vitamin A are responsible for muscle remodeling. And having looked at a lot of blood tests through the years and a lot of guys in this family, there is a lot of people that are vitamin D deficient. In particular, vitamin A is much harder to track. But there are two ways that you can target muscle remodeling really easily is by using vitamin A and vitamin D. There is a lot of research out there on iron. I do not advise males to supplement with iron. We are not like females. We don't bleed every month. what generally happens is men are more inclined to iron overload than they are to any sort of anemia is based off iron. So I wouldn't tell you to supplement with it, but using stuff like, and it tends to be the stuff that we neglect, we all eat collagen-based protein sources. So we all eat muscle. Very few of us actually eat liver or any organ meat. It's a really easy way to increase iron and copper in combination. But then some of the stuff in energy production is really, really interesting in regards to when we all assume that eating high protein diets have no downside. They do. It's just not widely spoken about. So there's three nutrients in particular that pop up over and over again that we deplete when we eat a high protein diet for long periods of time. And it's stuff you're probably not thinking about is biotin, which probably most of your wives take for skin and hair. It's B6 and it's molybdenum. These get consistently broken down when we eat a high protein diet, and they need to be replenished. And again, it comes back to the same thing. The way that we replenish these nutrients is not through collagen-based meat. It's not through chicken breast or fillet steak. It's through organ meat. So when you look at liver, spleen, kidney, even brain are really, really high, particularly molybdenum, biotin, and B6. So there are things you have to take into consider micronutrition-wise when you look at the way. So Josh just asked, is giving blood routinely the way to be going? I would advise the vast majority of men to give blood quarterly or at least twice a year. It's a really easy way to lower iron stores, and it's a really effective way, especially if any of you guys have high ferritin or have high iron on a blood test. It's a really quick way to lower those down. If anybody is actually using either anabolic steroids or testosterone replacement, thank you very much, Russell, that increases the absorption of iron across the gut lining. I've seen a lot of blood tests, even on T people who are on just on TRT, and I see iron overload all the time. It's extremely pro-inflammatory to our body if we have too much iron. And it should be checked. And it's one thing I see when from TRT doctors that they never check is iron and ferritin. So you took me away from my point, but thank you for that. It was a good one. In regards to then around energy production, so what nutrients do you need to make energy efficiently? And it's all the stuff that most people won't. Don't necessarily consider taking. I can guarantee everyone in this room is taking a protein. Everyone in this room is taking creatine. Everyone is probably taking beta-alanine or some sort of test booster. But you all forget the actual basic micronutrients that actually help us produce energy to either recover from weight training or allow us to actually express our strength and grow muscle. And you generally want to think all the B vitamins bar B12, so B1, B2, B3, B5. Alpha lipoic acid, CoQ10, copper, iron, which you wouldn't supplement with, and carnitine. These are the things, and magnesium, excuse me. And a lot of you will take magnesium for sleep, but it's also really responsible for energy production. So we are, although like looking at everything at a macro level is great, but most of the guys on this call know what their protein is and they hit it for the most part. You know what your carbohydrates are and you know what your fats are. And you hit them regularly, but you don't consider some of the underlying mechanisms that may be affecting you in regards to your long-term ability to gain muscle outside of those things. So, if we think macro level first, always control those aspects. When we look at micro, then afterwards, don't jump immediately to the fancy supplements that you assume will help you gain muscle. Protein supplement, fine, and creatine, obviously. But think of the other macronutrients that are involved. Think of the B vitamins, CoQ10, carnitine, and alpha lipoic acid in particular. So Gabe asked, any difference for carb sources? I would say no at a very basic level. So they will all inevitably do the same thing. Fructose, though, is special So they'll call it lipogenic. And that makes it sound really bad, like it just puts on fat. But one thing that fructose does that glucose doesn't. So glucose, sucrose, you can generally think of as table sugar, is just a combination of glucose and fructose. But why fructose was so demonized in the nutritional sphere for so long is because when you look at like producing energy or accumulating fat, there's normally this negative feedback that the body gets. So if there's too much glucose coming into a cell, and either we can't store it as fat quick enough or we can't produce energy with it, it sends this negative feedback down the loop and says, I don't want any more within the cell. There's too much going on. They call it metabolic gridlock. Whereas fructose is quite sly and special in the sense that it can bypass that. So it will just keep shuttling it within the cell, either producing more, like you hear in certain circumstances, like reactive oxygen species, all these other things, but also it can accumulate fat in those particular circumstances much, much quicker, but only in a calorie surplus. So maybe I would go down the route of glucose or a variation of it over fructose. But good question, Gabe. Has anybody got any other questions about that? So even around about possibly your own specific goals, just figured fructose is more of liver support rather than muscle glycogen restoration. When I'm bulking, I choose more glucose heavy foods. Yeah, that's also quite a good point. It doesn't replenish glycogen stores, and that's probably what good old Charles Poliquin was talking about back in the day as well. So it doesn't replenish glycogen stores. It does produce energy relatively well, but probably not what I'd want to use because of the mechanisms I mentioned earlier. Has anyone else got any questions of anything they want to go over, or like any specific problems that they're experiencing at the moment? It doesn't necessarily have to be in terms of muscle growth. It can be in terms of any nutritional questions you guys have, or if you have anything for Coach Steve around weightlifting or anything like that.
I got one for you, Greg. How might dietary, like how would you structure your diet around hypertrophy if you might start off the program with like a higher body fat percentage versus lower?
Oh, that's a really good question. A lot of the circumstances, well, I suppose I would generally, and what do you mean? Actually, that's a good question. What do you mean by higher body fat?
Let's just say that you're north of like 18%.
I would most likely try and get the person leaner in that circumstance before I'd start pushing up in terms of muscle growth. And the only reason why I say that, not to say you can't put on muscle when you're 18% body fat, that's not true. It's not true, but what tends to happen as we increase body fat and we're in a surplus is something that's called a P ratio. So inevitably, and I'm sure we've all done this on a bulk at some stage, you begin lean, and as you begin to accumulate, and sometimes people just gain lean mass, sometimes people will accumulate fat at the same time, but they'll hit a certain threshold of fat accumulation. And then, generally speaking, they'll only put on or predominantly body fat after that. And this tends to be like a split in what's called a P ratio. So our body no longer picks the excess nutrients to be put into muscle. It automatically just puts them more so in terms of fat stores. But if I had someone at 18% body fat who was looking to increase muscle mass, I would be looking at a smaller surplus for sure. So whatever surpluses you tend to look at, so if you were to look at 10 or 20%, I would put it at 20. I would probably have carbohydrates slightly lower, only because I'd imagine the utilization of those would not be as effective at the higher percentage body fat. But other than that, no, I wouldn't. There's not much else I'd change.
I do like that though. Thanks for giving that. I had a client a long time ago that when he first started the program, just because when he was younger, he predominantly used carbs. He was also leaner when he was younger. And so my suggestion at the time was that we cut a lot of carbs and just rely on fat and then, really chew in, optimize some zone two. He plays a little Mario game. And so, yeah. And so he did really good and he ended up losing like 80 pounds. And then once he dropped his weight, then he brought carbs back in. And then he got a crazy response from that. And I remember one of the things he said, he was like, "See, I told you my body wanted carbs." I'm like, "Whoa." And I was like, "Oh, no, it doesn't work." Like, we did something there you were unaware of. So I'm glad to hear you say that.
Like, I think carbohydrates are that more so manipulatable of the macronutrients. And a lot of the time, and this is generalization for sure, but when I'm pulling someone into a deficit, I find it easiest to pull the calories from carbohydrates. When I put them into a surplus, I like to push carbohydrates to increase calorie intake for two reasons. What I mentioned earlier, in fact, it's protein sparing, but also carbohydrates is relatively more difficult to turn into body fat than actual fat is. So it's called de novo lipogenesis, and it actually takes up energy. So if we've got excess calories that we have to store as body fat, we've eaten too much, we've gone past that P ratio. If we have to convert carbohydrates into fat, it actually, the body takes energy to do so. So technically, you will gain less body fat if the surplus is in carbohydrate than you will if it's in fat, dietary fat, I should say. That's a really good question. So Gabe asked, protein timing, would you suggest a pre-bed protein boost to get an MPS boost while you sleep, even if you already hit caloric goals? It's weighing it up. Personally, I don't tend to give people that. A lot of the reasons is I generally don't want food in their stomach when they go to bed. It tends to affect sleep. Food in their stomach will tend to affect growth hormone secretion throughout the night. It'll tend to affect your ability to digest that food at the same time. I like my clients, even in a surplus, to go to bed on a relatively empty stomach. Like, they don't have to stop eating like 5 hours beforehand or anything like that. But I like that time as clearance time. So this is the time where your body goes more so into what's called like beta oxidation. So it goes into repair processes, and it doesn't do that very well when there's food in the system. So probably not. Now, where there is some issues with that, if people have a really high caloric intake, so if you have a hard gainer and they just have to consume the calories, I'd probably, in that circumstance, yeah, I'd use something like that. But it's a good question. Less of a ratio limit fat gain. Any thoughts on per meal carb cap? Not necessarily. I think it will also be determined on what you've done beforehand, right? Like 30 to 40 grams of protein, shoot for 30 to 40 grams of protein generally was always thought of as the most beneficial in terms of increasing what I spoke about earlier, like mTOR, muscle protein synthesis. But if you consume protein over that, it's not that it's a waste. It just goes to other processes. So I don't necessarily worry if someone has to eat 60 grams in a meal in order to hit a target. That extra 20 grams is not wasted. It just will go to generally other processes. In terms of carb cap, I normally, however I like to split my day with a client, I'll put the majority, and not always, but I'll put the majority of my carbohydrates around training sessions and then the last meal of the day in order to help with sleep. So I would normally break it down in that way. So if I had someone who was who was on four meals a day, for example, for cognitive function, I like to leave the first one relatively carb free. And then I like to put carbohydrates around the training session and then the evening so that they can help them sleep, just so they utilize their carbohydrates well. I don't sleep well. I wake up multiple times. However, I eat something. I tend to sleep. That's a really good one. So Andy said, I notice when I go to bed hungry, I don't sleep well. I wake up multiple times. However, I eat something satiating, such as oatmeal with cinnamon and raisins about an hour before bed, I tend to sleep much better. I would imagine that. So when you look at it, so there's a couple of things there. People always talk about like cortisol, right? So cortisol will stop you from sleeping, or it'll stop the production of melatonin, which will help you sleep. The only macronutrient, as far as I can remember, that plays on that at all is carbohydrate. So if you're particularly stressed in the evening, taking in carbohydrate will help lower that stress level. Also, increasing or spiking makes it sound like it's a bad thing. Increasing insulin in the evening can help with the production of serotonin and melatonin because it pulls, without getting too deep into it, it pulls tryptophan into the brain to help to produce it. So some people, when they eat carbohydrates in the evening, it helps them relax and helps them sleep. It's why some people, when they swap to really low carbohydrate diet, they in certain circumstances can really struggle with sleep, at least in the beginning. Does fasting in the morning have a place in hypertrophy phase for those that experience increased focus and work performance when fasted? It's a tricky one, right? Because you're weighing up your ability to be able to focus with the goals that you have physically. In that circumstance, for people, I would normally go high protein, high fat in the morning to hit a certain amount of calories. You can do it without it, but you're going to go an awful long time without stimulating muscle protein synthesis, what I spoke about earlier, Alex. So it's difficult. It just becomes more difficult in that circumstance. Like in a caloric deficit, man, if that made you feel better, I'd be like, don't worry about it. Eat when you want. But if you're purely in a surplus and concentrating specifically on muscle growth, then I would probably look to eat protein and fat in the morning. Would you have any other idea, any other thoughts on that, Steve, if you were to have someone who wanted to fast in the morning?
I think you nailed it, man, especially with the first thing you said, which was that it has to be in alignment with your goals, right? I get asked a lot of the questions like that from clients who seem to be trying to find their way in this, which is that they are trying to like compare the nuance of this information of the modern age, right? Usually from things like Huberman podcast. And it's not that it's wrong, it's great information, but it doesn't necessarily coincide with somebody who's trying to get jacked. Because if you're trying to get jacked, like we got to do what jack guys have done for ages, which is got to train hard, got to eat a lot of food. And it's going to be that, right? So I think that there can be like I think, you know, I've been flattering Jimmy, but like Jimmy does a great job of doing kind of all the things. I'm surprised he's not like juggling flaming knives because that's kind of how he lives. But he's that kind of guy where he's able to manage all these things because he has like the time to do it. But most of us are just trying to get our meals in, right? But I think these things can be beneficial when you're trying to essentially like, you know, balance the meals and then try to not overrun your timing and sleep. And then like the guy is saying like, how you have this problem with focus. Because I had the same thing. Like if I eat too much, I feel like I'm just a slug, but I grow. So what's the answer, right?
That's good, man. I think it is. It's about aligning what the goal is. So a lot of the time, you might be able to find a way between both by possibly eating high protein fat for breakfast and still keeping that focus. Our branched chain amino acid supplement's a big benefit. No, I would go with if you're hitting adequate protein targets, it tends to be fine without them. So branched chain amino acids are really beneficial in people who don't hit an adequate protein target for sure, because it has leucine in it, and leucine's actually the amino acid that boosts mu muscle protein synthesis over the rest of them. So it does show benefit, but also with it depend and it also depends on the it depends on the percentages. You see some of these coming out now that are like, you know, six parts leucine to one part isoleucine to one part valine. And that's got a real problem around blood sugar regulation, man. If you smash those for long periods of time, you'll end up with, I'm not going to say diabetes, but you'll have bad blood sugar control. And also, one thing that branched chain amino acids do that the other ones don't is they compete with the amino acids that help us produce neurotransmitters. So like tyrosine or tryptophan. They compete with those amino acids to get into the brain. So there's a lot of anecdotal evidence of people out there drinking a lot of branched chain amino acids who become mildly depressed. So there's a couple of things with it. It's not something I personally advise people to take if they're hitting an adequate protein target. So if working your first thing fasted, would you suggest a carb supplement to mitigate gluconeogenesis? I would for sure. It wouldn't necessarily, I wouldn't imagine that you're going to get much gluconeogenesis while you train, but in order to spare glycogen, for sure. And also as a fuel source to train with, I would definitely advise people, especially if they're bulking, to use a carb source if it just has to be supplemental. Oh, here's a good one. As a trucker, manual labor, I'm essentially working out twice a day and still eat enough to maintain and gain. And it's a huge struggle, especially getting in dinner. So, would multiple meals early in the day suffice, or small calorie dense snacks do? Ooh. It's a good question. So, if you were to look at having multiple meals earlier in the day, would that mean you would be having long periods of time without eating, John? Because I would say if that's the case, it kind of answers your question. I would, and someone else can jump in here if you have a different opinion, but I would say like smaller calorie dense snacks and a couple of big meals would probably be more beneficial in that circumstance, depending on what the snack is, again, right?
Okay, that's my biggest issue right now. It's just like trying to, as a driver, get large meals in as I'm moving around throughout the day. And then I get off, I go in, I knock out the workout. I don't get off until 5:30, 6 o'clock in the afternoon. Gym's packed, go in there, get my session in. But sometimes it takes a little bit longer. I get off, get out of there 8:30, 9 o'clock, and then I'm trying to stuff a meal and then go to bed hour and a half later, type of deal, and then still get quality sleep. So it's a bit of a conundrum.
That is a tricky one. I would say most likely whatever you find the most efficient way to get your calories in is what I would pick the vast majority of the time in that circumstance. So like if you find that you need like dense high calorie snacks in order to get that and you're still putting on muscle as you would expect and you're still training adequately, I'd probably lean slightly more towards that then trying to find time in a super busy day to slam big meals where it might be affecting your sleep afterwards.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
No problem, John. Anyone else got anything last things to say? Actually, I'm in no rush. So if anyone else has any questions.
Hey guys, one thing to bring up about Spain. We're exactly 5 weeks out from Spain, and not everyone's going to be able to make it as far as space. So if you guys haven't already signed up, if you don't already about Spain, we do a quarterly men's retreat called the Warrior and the Monk, where it'll be the most effective training you've ever experienced in your life. 7 days in Marbella, and Greg's nodding his head like, yep, it's going to be better than you think. Our goal is to always massively exceed your expectations. And the one, if you guys see any of the videos on Instagram about Costa Rica, I think this is going to be a step up from Costa Rica. We've got some incredible stuff planned. The Marbella, Spain is one of the most beautiful places in the world, and it's probably the best gyms in the entire world. And where this came, idea came to me was, I spent 3 weeks there last year, and like, man, every human needs a training vacation once, 1 or 2 times a year, and just like go away, spend 1 or 2 weeks like going hard. You get such a an advantage. It's like a kickstart for the rest of your year. Like my training after February next year just skyrocketed. So we decided to do this every quarter. And I'd love to have you guys there. Talk to your coach about details. I can drop details in the chat box. Yeah, we're doing our best to keep the cost down as much as possible. And guys, if you can put it on a credit card and pay it later, like move heaven and earth to get there, because it's gonna blow your mind what you're capable of, ex over and above what you think you are now. So anyway, and I know Matt will tell you, Matt and I got an opportunity to spend, I don't know, 60 minutes together in the gym. And I'm gonna speculate that that was a useful 60 minutes, and you guys will get enormous amount of time with me, enormous amount of time with all the coaches. So, like, if you have a desire to improve your health and fitness in the next 12 months, which everyone does that's here, That's a fast track.
I'll just chirp in, Benny. It was wickedly, wickedly good. Thank you so much for that. It was super helpful.
Cost for training camp, I think, is like $2,000. Well, obviously plus travel. We do have some accommodations booked, and we do have some group rates. So if you guys want to get in on that, get on that, because there's a limited number of spaces available in the group block. So we'll all stay together in a hotel. We're going to curate meals for everybody. So you guys won't have to worry about that. That'll all be, I believe it's all included, I think. So the meals are awesome. We have a really great meal prep company there. So yeah, it's just an incredible experience. Marbella is on the ocean. We'll spend some time on the beach. We'll be doing a lot of stuff outside. The reason is the monk. The Warriors is expressing or exploring all the sides of your physical capability. We're going to push hard. And then the monk is so the warrior is the doing, right? Like, how hard can I do? Can I develop the doing and get myself in the best shape of my life? And then the being is the warrior. It's like, how do I just learn to be in solitude with self, in connecting with spirit and my soul? And that's the warrior and the monk. And there's a lot. I think that's how we develop ourselves as a man. I have this belief that there's this dynamic balance of being and doing, right? The doing is the masculine and the being is the feminine, the receiving. And, you know, you have to have both. You have to have really clear purpose, mission, vision, and outcomes. And you have to be willing to know that purpose, vision, mission, and outcomes is on the right path. And the only way to do that is by connecting deeply with your soul. So if you're someone who's lacking fulfillment in life or wanting to step up your level of fulfillment, this could be this is certainly a step in the right direction. And I do my best to push you both mentally and physically. I'll ask you some hard questions. I'll call you on your bullshit, and as well as the other coaches. So I welcome you guys. I hope we can get there. And we do have payment plans and stuff, I think, available. So that helps you guys. Thanks, man. Appreciate the insight. Sometimes embassies aren't the easiest to get along with. All right, everybody. I know we had some new faces on here. Thank you guys for being here. I look forward to seeing you guys again. Actually, I don't think I'll be here next Wednesday. I'm going to be skiing with my kids. So I appreciate y'all being here, and I'll see y'all in 2 weeks. There's still a call next week, though. I just won't be here. See you guys.
Thanks, Ben.
Thank you. If you have questions about Marbella, feel free to send me a message.